This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Economic vocabulary is where we find ourselves today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 25th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our way into the economic news of this Tuesday comes to us via one Jay Powell and something he said at a press conference a couple of 3 years ago, but which seems especially relevant today given everything, by which I mean Wall Street and the agita that happens when stocks do what they have been doing of late. Anyway, here is Jay Powell, January 2019.
We don't react to most things that happen in the financial markets, but when we see a sustained change in financial conditions, then that's something that has to play into our thinking. In fact, our policy works through changing financial conditions, so it's sort of the essence of what we do.
Okay, financial markets versus financial conditions. That is the next 3.5 minutes of this program, and we are spending it with Kate Davidson, who wrote about this in the Politico Morning Money newsletter today. She is with us regularly on Fridays as well, so we got her on the phone to talk things over. Hey, Kate.
Hey, Kai.
Okay, so super simple here. Financial markets are what?
Oh, so financial markets, we're talking about the stock market, mm-hmm. right? Equities, kind mm-hmm. of what we hear you talk about every day, what happened in markets today, you know, very straightforward. We're talking about bond markets, okay. Commercial bonds, treasury bonds. So that's the gist
regular,
of it.
Got it. Regular run-of-the-mill
right.
stuff. Okay, now, financial conditions. What does that mean?
So financial conditions, you know, it's easy to think about, you know, when we're talking about regular people, your ability to get a mortgage, your ability to get a credit card or a car loan and the rate that you're paying on those things. Those are financial conditions. When they tighten, rates go up. And this is true for, you know, business loans as well, for government loans. When it becomes harder, a little bit harder to borrow, when money is not quite as easy. And we're in a period now where the Fed, and I don't want to get ahead of you, but they want to tighten financial
yeah.
conditions a little bit.
Right. And they want to do that because the economy is running a little hot and they think it maybe doesn't need as much help as it's been getting, right?
Exactly. When okay. things were bad, when the pandemic was happening, they wanted to throw everything they could at the economy to support it, to make sure that credit was still flowing. That's extremely important to the overall functioning of the economy is credit. And now, you know, they've decided we're getting back to a normal, more normal place. We don't need to provide so much support.
Right. And those financial conditions tighten. Now, it looks sometimes that the Fed is coming to the rescue of the markets. And what you pointed out this morning in Morning Money was, you know what? Yeah, sometimes it does look like they're coming to the rescue of the financial markets, but actually it's the financial conditions that they're working on. Explain that a little bit.
Right. I was talking to someone who said that this is referred to it as really a common misperception.
Yeah.
It's definitely true that Fed policies, you know, tend to help equity holders. And they've faced a lot of criticism for that.
Mm-hmm.
But what former Fed officials and people who really follow this stuff say is it's not just the fact that stocks are falling. You know, what really prompts them to kind of respond, whether they're intervening when something bad is happening or maybe backing off of something they're going to do, it has to do with those financial conditions. So stocks falling, like we've seen early this year, in and of themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's not going to worry the Fed. What would worry them is if it led to a change or a deterioration, really a negative change in credit conditions and financial conditions. That's when they might respond. And that's essentially what Jay Powell was saying
right.
in the clip that you just played.
Right. And which I would guess that he would repeat in some some way, shape, or form tomorrow at his press conference after their two-day meeting. Okay, super quick. Let me ask you this, and I hate to do this to you on a 45-second clock, but here's the question. The stock market, I think everybody agrees, has been disconnected from the underlying economy for a while now, right? It's been soaring even as the financials conditions have been tense, especially at the beginning of this pandemic. Now the underlying economy is pretty strong, and yet stocks are falling. Is it disconnected on the way down too, or the market's disconnected on the way down?
Oh, that, you know, I'm not, I wish I could answer that. That is a tough question to answer. I mean, I think that they might still be a little bit disconnected. That's the worry, is should things be getting, one question is, should things be getting even tighter? Is the Fed going to have to be even more aggressive in signaling that they're going to rein in inflation? Because things have been really, really accommodative is the word the Fed uses. Yep. Conditions are still pretty loose. So they're tightening. And, you know, some folks I talked to said that's a good thing. That's what the Fed would want to see. As long as credit markets don't seize, I think that they'll be pretty comfortable with what's happening.
Kate Davidson, her newsletter is called Morning Money at Politico. You ought to sign up if you haven't already. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Talk to you soon. In those financial markets today, by the way, just like yesterday, maybe not quite as turbulent, you could say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, changing gears. Geopolitics is never just politics, right? There is the national security aspect, there's economics, and there's energy, too. And we are talking here, obviously, about Russia and Ukraine, on the subject of which the White House said today it's working with gas and oil producers to shore up energy supplies to Europe. More than a third of Europe's natural gas comes from Russia, so the concern here is pretty obvious, especially as we've been reporting, at a time when supplies are already low and prices are already high. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the latest on energy.
Ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia has been paying Ukraine to allow its pipelines to transport natural gas to consumers in Europe.
Ukraine is kind of like a landlord, and Russia is kind of like a tenant.
That's Tom Sanzillo with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
And it's an ornery tenant. You know, one that you would normally not rent to.
But Ukraine needs the rent money from the pipeline contract. So even though it knows the apartment's going to be trashed, it can't let the place just sit there vacant. And so Russian President Vladimir Putin is flexing his power. And he's chosen to do so in the winter, when Europeans are most dependent on Russia's natural gas. But Amy Myers-Jaffe says this may be Putin's last chance to use gas as a weapon. She runs the Climate Policy Lab at Tufts University.
As more countries electrify, and as that electricity comes from a diversified source of things, you know, the sort of leverage that large export systems like the Russian gas export system will actually become less important over time.
Putin is trying to remind Europe that he controls that old energy system, says Nico Safos at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Europe knows this, and that's one of the reasons why it wants to move away from Russian gas. Question is, as Putin.
You would think that a rational actor would understand that the energy system is changing and you want to be part of that energy system.
Instead, he says, if Putin messes with Europe's gas supply, that's only likely to encourage more investment in renewable energy. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
At midnight tonight, Pacific Gas and Electric, the biggest utility in the state of California, gets out from under 5 years of federal probation. It landed there as a result of its culpability in a gas pipeline explosion that killed eight people a decade ago. But the thing is that even while on probation, the company violated the terms of it to not commit more crimes more than once. That term was violated. It pleaded guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter in the 2018 Camp Fire. I'm sure you heard of that. That was started by PG&E Power Lines. It's being criminally prosecuted right now into other fires. More charges are in the offing. And that gets us to the point. What does it take exactly to hold a company accountable? Marketplace's Lily Jamali has been covering the PG&E story for years.
Odds are good you've heard about the legal concept that corporations are people. But Sandra Waddock of Boston College's Carroll School of Management says U.S. law shields corporations from a lot of the stuff actual people have to deal with.
The problem is companies, they're not really human beings. They are comprised of human beings. People are making those decisions.
People in those companies can go to jail in theory, but she notes,
how often does that happen? Not very often, right?
Despite the rap sheet PG&E has racked up over the last several years, the U.S. attorney in San Francisco chose not to ask for an extension of its probation. That upset William Abrams, one of tens of thousands of Northern California fire survivors. He lost his home in 2017.
Every probation violation has caused additional harms to victims who are dependent on PG&E stock.
Dependent because fire victims now own a quarter of the company as part of a bankruptcy settlement. PG&E filed for Chapter 11 largely as a result of having caused all of those fires. Fire victims are frustrated with PG&E, but Siri Turgeson of Florida Atlantic University's College of Business says companies are under more scrutiny than they used to be.
I would like to think that issues that might have gone unnoticed decades ago would be addressed much sooner now.
PG&E has acknowledged that as a corporation, it has more work to do, but said it has become a fundamentally safer company during its probation. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Good news and maybe some bad news today for college-bound high schoolers here and internationally. The bad news is that the SAT is still happening. The good news is that it's going to be just a little bit less painful. No more number two pencils, for one thing. The College Board announced today the SAT is going digital, starting in 2023 internationally, 2024 here. It'll be on a laptop or on a tablet. Still, though, at a school or a testing site, and also just 2 hours down from three. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has the latest on the testing industrial complex.
All those little answer bubbles on the SAT have long been what stand between a kid and college. That and the $55 test price. And Bob Schaefer at the National Center for Fair and Open Testing says there are lots of other fees.
To send extra scores to additional schools costs additional money. To get a copy of your test so you can learn from the testing experience, that costs $18. To register late, there's an additional fee.
He says all of this has been lucrative for the College Board and standardized testing company ACT Inc. until recently, when the pandemic interrupted testing and schools started changing requirements. More than 1,800 schools currently don't require the SAT.
That's more than three quarters of all four-year accredited colleges in the United States.
More colleges are asking if these tests are even fair. Studies show low-income students tend to score lower than those who have access to test prep programs and tutors. And people who speak English as a second language have a disadvantage. Some argue grades are a better way to evaluate students. Dan Koritz, who researches testing policy at Harvard, isn't sure there's a perfect answer.
The dirty little secret of college admissions is it's hard to predict how kids are going to do altogether. It doesn't matter how much information you have.
The University of California has permanently removed testing from its admissions process. Other schools like Emory University have suspended it temporarily. John Ladding is the dean of admission.
My prediction is that for colleges and universities that have the discretion to make their own test policies, test optional is here to stay.
Test optional, which means the more user-friendly the SAT becomes, the more likely students are to pay for the stress of taking it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In a beautiful neighborhood lined with 100-year-old live oak trees.
Sounds nice, I guess. First, though, let's do the numbers. This is so funny. I would not have picked the Wawas today. Although maybe I would have, because the Dow was down 818 points at one point today. Ended up down 66 points, about 0.2%, closed at 34,297. The NASDAQ dropped 315 points, just shy of 2 3/10%. 13,539. The S&P 500 sank 53 points, 1.2%, 43.56. Word from Andy Euler about the role of natural gas in the conflict over Ukraine. Looking at some U.S. petroleum stocks, ExxonMobil up 2.9% today. Chevron Corporation gained 4.2%. To those financial conditions, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.78%. Jay Powell, tomorrow, the Fed. See you there. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The International Monetary Fund was out with its new economic outlook this morning, and the headline was not too bad. 4.4% global growth this year. That is down from the 4.9% the IMF was expecting last fall, but, you know, there's been a lot going on. That said, though, the details are somewhat less encouraging, so we have gotten Geeta Gopinath on the line. She is the now former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Dr. Gopinath, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Always a pleasure.
So I'm going to read you the first line of the first page of this report, and then we're going to talk about it. The global economy, the World Economic Outlook from the International Monetary Fund says, enters 2022 in a weaker position than previously expected. That is not good news.
Well, we certainly have a downgrade, and it's being driven by quite significant downgrades for two of the most largest economies, which is the U.S. and for China.
The obvious answer is that it's Omicron, but what else are you, or were you, since you've moved on, and we'll get to that in a minute, what else were you thinking about as you made this forecast?
So, Kai, actually, the obvious answer is not the correct answer.
Oh.
Omicron, we expect...
That's why you're the economist in the conversation.
We expect Omicron will have a negative impact in the first quarter of this year, but then we expect that effect to come off. So for the year as a whole, it's only explaining about minus 0.1 percentage point of downgrade. The downgrade really comes for the U.S., which is for three reasons. One, we don't longer have the Build Back Better fiscal package in our baseline. Monetary tightening is going to start. And supply disruptions, especially including in the labor market, are lasting longer than we expected.
Okay, so Build Back Better in the United States, politics is going to be what politics is going to be. So let's take that out of the equation for a second, because that's not knowable fundamentally. The Federal Reserve monetary tightening, as you know, there's a meeting going on today and tomorrow. The Fed, unless something drastic happens, is going to tighten. It is going to raise interest rates. It is going to sell off its balance sheet. And that, to you, is a concern for growth in the United States, you say.
No, my view is that the U.S. recovery has been very strong. It's basically back to where it would have been in the absence of the pandemic based on previous projections. On the other hand, inflation is very high. So for it's clear that the U.S. Fed should raise interest rates. I can't project whether they will do it this time around or in the future, but they certainly would see some monetary tightening, which then would slow growth down some, which is part of the solution to bringing down inflation.
One more thing about the states, and then I'll turn to the global economy. Are you team transitory, or are you inflation is going to be with us for a while?
I think everybody's terribly confused about what the word transitory means.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell you what our projected path looks like. Our projected path is for inflation in the U.S. to peak in the first quarter of this year and then to decline. So it comes down to 3.4%, but that's still above the 2% target of the Fed. So it's going to take a while to get back to 2%. That's more in our projections. That shows happens in 2023.
So spitball this for me. And I know that's against your inclination as an economist, but 2022 is going to be what 2022 is going to be. And you lay that out here. What about the out years, 23, 24? Is there a sense of normalcy anywhere in your, even in your internal Geeta Gopinath projections?
Well, I mean, we should first recognize that after a historic contraction in 2020, the global economy did rebound quite strongly in 2021. Mm-hmm. The problem is that countries have recovered at very divergent paces. But our expectation is that by the end of this year, we will truly exit the acute phase of the pandemic, at least in terms of the economic impact really out of this pandemic. But again, there's been surprises galore these past years.
Yes, there have. Quickly about you. You've had a couple of year run here at the IMF as the chief economist. You're not going back to Harvard to the life of an academic. You're staying at the IMF. You've gotten kicked upstairs. You're going to be the first deputy managing director at the International Monetary Fund. Why?
Well, in my 3 years that I've been doing this job, and especially the past 2 years, I got to see the difference one can make by bringing together rigorous economic analysis and public policy to be in that intersection. So I figured that given where the world is, that I should continue for some more time in public service.
Dr. Geeta Gopinath was, until I guess a week or so ago, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now the first deputy managing director at the IMF. Dr. Gopinath, thanks for your time. I appreciate it and your thoughts and your expertise.
Thank you, Kai.
For the part of the workforce that can do it, this pandemic has brought a pretty big benefit, being able to decide where you want to live and remote work. Maybe giving up expensive cities like New York or San Francisco for more affordable ones, for now anyway, like Austin or Boise. A lot of companies are bought into that, but some of them, including big names in tech that we all know and love, have made it clear that that kind of move could come with a change in pay and not to the upside. Compensation based on location was actually pretty normal practice in the before times, but these times ain't those, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino tells us.
Like a lot of folks, Stephen Boatwright found a new hobby during the pandemic.
I've been learning to build puppets. That's been really fun.
Boatwright works full-time editing promotional video for Scale Media, an e-commerce startup. Being cooped up at home has given him a bit more time and a little more space since he and his fiancée moved last fall from a cramped one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles to a house in his hometown of Savannah, Georgia.
We are now paying about 70% of what we were paying for rent for a three-bedroom house with a fenced yard in a beautiful neighborhood lined with 100-year-old live oak trees.
While his cost of living has gone down by about a third, his salary has stayed the same. Boatwright says that feels fair.
If I'm achieving my deliverables, there's not a detriment to the work or the company based on my location, then I feel like my value to the company is consistent.
But some employers see things differently, says Johnny C. Taylor Jr., who heads the Society for Human Resource Management.
Where the work is done has for a very, very long time dictated salary.
Taylor himself has experienced this when he transferred from New York City to Charlotte, North Carolina, while working for digital media company IAC about a decade ago.
Listen, I took a pay cut, but I knew even with my pay cut, I had a much better and higher quality of life because the cost of living was so much lower.
Conversely, some companies adjust wages up when workers move to a more expensive area, so they don't experience a cut in real wages. Which begs the question, why? Why would any company want to pay a premium to lure workers to an expensive city? What did they ever get out of it?
Most of the time, we think it's got to be more productive. Higher wages have to be a sign of higher productivity.
Edward Glaser is an economist at Harvard and the author of Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation. He says the move by certain companies to continue to base pay on location could be seen as belief in the productivity gains that come from the physical clustering of industries like finance in New York City or tech in Silicon Valley.
It's not about short-term stuff. It's about long-term stuff. It's about the learning that doesn't happen when we're remote. It's about the new relationships that don't form.
He says regions that concentrate talent tend to be more innovative. They produce more patents and spur more new businesses, thanks to the interactions and competition that happen in proximity. The question is whether proximity needs to be physical, or whether the same gains can now be made virtually. Stephen Boatwright in Savannah says his location hasn't changed how he works, though it has helped to inspire his puppet-making passion. He's now trying to perfect the voice for a goofy-looking fuzzy blue character he calls Duke Miles.
He's definitely smoked way too many cigarettes, and he's from the South.
A region that Boatwright can now call home again. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Case Shiller was out this morning. Steadfast listeners will know that's the benchmark home price index. Those prices up 18.8% in November 2021 as measured from November 2020. Not a promising affordable housing indicator. What might give you some solace if you happen to be in the housing market is that that's just slightly slower than the October annual rise of 19%. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. One more thing on this, and then I'll get off it, I promise. That Bills-Chiefs game on Sunday, almost 52 million people were watching at one point. But sure, NFL, let's settle it with a coin toss. $9 billion business, that is. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.